again, but he has worked directly in the industry, so he's very familiar with the quality assurance responsibilities in our companies. He joined NC State in 2008 and leads research projects involving food safety and the quality of poultry meat. So, and this morning, Doug's going to talk to us a little bit about the claims or terms you may see on fresh chicken packages in your supermarket meat department. And next up, we have Yvonne Vizier-Thaxton. And she's an expert on poultry welfare. She serves as director and professor at the Center for Food Animal Well-Being at the University of Arkansas. The center's goal is improvement of animal health, animal handling, food safety, and productivity through the use of optimal welfare practices. She's also served on several animal welfare advisory panels. She's currently on the American Humane Association Scientific Advisory Committee. She's had hundreds of articles published and lectures delivered on animal welfare. She's received numerous awards and was named a Professor Emeritus at Mississippi State in 2011. Yvonne, you're not old enough to be an emeritus, but they gave it to you anyway. She's also a former member of the media. She was the executive editor for several years in Poultry Magazine. Then our final panelist this morning is Kendra Walbeezer, who is Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality Assurance at Pilgrim's Pride in Greeley, Colorado. Kendra was raised on a commercial egg operation in West Tennessee. She received a BS in Animal Science and an MS in Comparative and Experimental Medicine from the University of Tennessee. Go Vols. And she started the poultry industry immediately after college. She spent 13 years at Tyson Foods prior to joining Pilgrim's in 2010. In her current role, she's responsible for the quality assurance staff at all of Pilgrim's 36 processing rendering locations, as well as the four regional laboratories. She manages product services department as well, which is the specifications, labeling, and packaging functions for Pilgrim's. Kendra is also currently the chairperson for the National Chicken Council's Technical and Regulatory Committee. Choi, please join me in welcoming all of our panelists. John, we're going to pick up just about where we left off at the last in the last session. Let me just ask you, from a veterinarian's perspective, certainly avian influenza is a big deal right now in China with the reports coming out of there. How do you look at that situation from a veterinarian perspective and review some of the controls that we do have to ensure that our product remains safe?
Well, from the perspective of disease control, the way veterinarians look at these things, we understand these diseases in much more detail than maybe it looks like sometimes. But the natural ecology of those viruses are spread by wild birds. So how do wild birds spread them? Well, wild birds spread those viruses primarily by migrating. So we know that the migration of birds from Asia to North America is almost non-existent. Birds don't fly across the Pacific Ocean. And so that's why in the past, when there would be a new avian influenza virus in Asia, people would get excited, most people. We the veterinarians, were not all that excited because we knew birds weren't flying across the Pacific. There is a little bit of exchange of birds right at the across the Bering Sea into Alaska, but those birds don't come down here. So for us, we worry about everything. We don't put that high on the list of that virus spreading North America. We're more concerned about avian influenza viruses that are already in the Americas because the migration rate of routes of the wild birds are north and south. So for instance, the avian influenza virus that's in poultry in Mexico is much more of a worry to us than the one that's in China.
John, I should follow my own script and allow you to give your opening remarks before I start asking questions.
That's okay.
So if you go ahead.
You know, 30 years as a university professor, you're used to just people asking you questions and making this answer. They asked me to talk about the role of a veterinarian in the poultry industry, and that's a bigger topic than 8 or 10 minutes, so I'm just going to kind of hit the high spots a little bit. For veterinarians working all through the poultry industry, the number one thing is to improve poultry health. And that's a very complex topic. But the way we look at it may be a little bit different than traditionally the way it's been looked at by the human medical profession. We're totally focused on disease prevention. We can't afford for birds to get sick for a lot of reasons. The health of the birds really is the major determinant on product quality and food safety. And so the only way that we can produce a good quality product and a safe product is to have healthy birds. So the last thing we want to do is treat sick birds. We want them not to get sick. So that's kind of the overview of how we work. Now, to let you know how this all works, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the way it used to be. And my perspective is from my youth, growing up in southern Georgia, where we had a small broiler industry. And in those days, I can tell you that probably 8 to 10% mortality was normal. That's where we were in those days. And when those birds would go to the processing plant, 6 to 8% of them would be condemned. Now, you saw the inspectors yesterday at the plant. When they pull a bird off of that line, for some reason, it's condemned. It can't go for human consumption. So we call that the condemnation rate. Now, for the perspective now, here in the U.S., if you look at all the chickens that are being produced, the mortality rate is down to 3 to 4%. From 8 to 10%. That's the progress since I had dark hair. The condemnation rate has gone from 6 to 8% down to 0.1 to 0.2% during that period of time. A lot of things contribute to that. A lot of it is poultry health programs, but a lot of it is the technology you saw in those chicken houses yesterday. There are a lot of things that will make you sick. You, me, chickens, if we don't take care of ourselves. Minor things, it'll give you a cold or give you this or that, they're minor viruses. So one of the things that's really been focused on, not just by veterinarians, but the whole industry, is providing food, water, lights, temperature, and airflow to those birds to keep them comfortable and happy. I told our group yesterday on the bus that we're in the chicken happiness business. There's no way to make money with chickens if they're not happy. And poultry health is a big part of that. So how did we get to the point we are now? I'm telling you all this to tell you the veterinarian's role. When I was a kid, there were a lot of diseases that we had in the poultry industry that were transmitted from the breeders down to the next generation, to the broilers, through the egg. It was impossible to control it. So this industry has gone through a period of several decades of eradicating these diseases out of the commercial chicken lines. Several of them just don't exist anymore in the chicken industry, in the turkey industry. They've been completely eradicated. And those programs are continuing today. There are a couple of diseases that are just really ravaging the poultry industries around the world. One is avian influenza. One is a disease we call exotic Newcastle disease. We have eradicated these from our industry. We've eradicated a couple species of salmonella from our industry. So these things have taken years and years and years and years. But that's part of why we are where we are today with this incredibly healthy flock of chickens in North America. We'll talk about the number of people in the world, you know, the billions of people in the world. I don't think I've heard the figure said, so I'll say it. How many chickens do we produce in this country a year? It's around 8 billion. It's about one chicken for every person on the planet. Now, you think about the number of people on this planet. A lot of them are getting sick. We're producing that many chickens and trying not to let one of them get sick. It's quite a challenge. It takes a lot of effort. One of the things that has happened in the way veterinarians have contributed, for the diseases we can't eradicate, we've developed really sophisticated vaccines and really sophisticated ways to apply those vaccines. You saw yesterday at the hatchery, some vaccines being sprayed on those chicks. That looks very simple. That represents about 40 years of research. what you saw there. What you didn't see are the vaccines that are injected into the embryo before it hatches. This type of work, I've always said, if it was being done in humans, would be Nobel Prizes. It's highly, highly advanced. It looks pretty simple now. It is pretty simple now. Another thing that's been mentioned several times is biosecurity. You noticed yesterday you did not go to a breeder farm. That's not because Sanderson didn't want you to see it. The biosecurity is so strict on those breeder farms, you can't take a group of people in there. It's too much disease risk. When we talk about biosecurity, the number one thing we're trying to control is people. Most of the diseases that come on a chicken farm walk onto that farm with 2 feet. People are the source of contamination for most things. But the other things that we have to keep that farm secure from are rats and mice. You wouldn't believe what rats and mice can take to your chickens. One of the ugly ones, salmonella, a lot of it comes from rats and mice. So the biosecurity is very intense. The other thing that we're really serious about keeping out of those farms are wild birds. And it's been mentioned, as a veterinarian, we worry about the free-range chickens and the backyard chickens because they're exposed to wild birds. I've already told you that wild birds are the source of avian influenza. We used to grow a lot of turkeys outdoors in this country. We call it growing them on the range. And every year, there'd be multiple flocks that would get infected with avian influenza. But you can imagine a flock of migrating birds flying over, and they see the 10,000 turkeys down there with big open feeders and drinkers. To them, that's the largest bird feeder they have ever seen. And they land in the middle of it, start living with the turkeys. A few days later, they have influenza. So what you saw, the style of housing yesterday, so my gosh, these birds are so contained. They're contained because of all the things we're trying to keep out. That's a big part of the biosecurity. To keep the diseases out, we've got to keep people, rodents, any kind of animals, as many insects out as we can, and first and foremost, keep the wild birds out. Today, veterinarians work in all these companies, and it's very program-driven. Sanderson Farms doesn't have 100 veterinarians. They have one or two veterinarians that are building programs and going to each of the complexes like the one here and training people to implement those programs, training people to monitor those programs. The veterinarian is visiting these places to monitor how his programs are going. That's the way it works now, at a level where the veterinarian can be multiplied by training other people. So the flock supervisors that you saw yesterday on the farm, that fella has had a lot of training. Most things that happen to chickens on that farm, he can recognize because he's been taught to recognize it. If he can't recognize it, he contacts the veterinarian. So the veterinarian then is fine-tuning these programs at all times. We're using new vaccines. New vaccines are being developed. New application methods are being developed to try to keep these birds from ever getting sick. So today, In the poultry industry, veterinarians are working in a lot of different places. They're working in production companies like Sanderson. They're working in the primary breeding companies, the genetics companies. The poultry genetics business is really dominated by the United States. The United States genetics companies are producing 60% of the breeding stock for the whole world. And I can tell you it's very, very important biosecurity there. The allied industries, vaccine companies, pharmaceutical companies, diagnostic labs, universities, USDA. But the future is going to be different. Veterinarians have become involved in many more things than just health. Now it's food safety, product quality, animal welfare, environment, export, interstate, commerce, and a big one is agricultural emergencies in case influenza or Newcastle disease comes back. So in summary, the U.S. poultry flock is very, very healthy, the healthiest it's ever been, which is one of the reasons we have such good quality product. And the veterinary programs continue to make incremental improvements.
Okay, thank you, John.
And folks, if you would, go ahead. If you have any questions, go ahead and put them on the yellow card and pass them, and Gwen will pick them up, or Tom will too when he gets done with the computer here. Doug, if you'd go ahead.
Sound okay on the back? Okay. Well, appreciate the invitation to be here, and hopefully everybody's enjoyed their stay in North Carolina so far this week. Anybody like to go to Tryon Palace? Just two blocks over, nice gardens. Just want to point out that the person who built that place and lived there, Governor Tryon, from my great-great-great-great-grandfather. I found out that story. My family's from North Carolina, not from Georgia, but when I moved back to North Carolina, I found out about that story.
Do you deserve it?
Well, I thought it was probably horse thievery or something, but it turns out that 5 years before the American Revolution, North Carolina revolted against British rule, and he was one of the ringleaders, and so they hung six of those at the Hillsborough Courthouse. And luckily, he was a prolific gentleman, so he had his children before his unfortunate end. I've been asked to talk this morning about labeling, chicken part labeling. I'm a professor, so I got to talk, and I don't think I can sit down and talk. I don't think I have much choice this morning. And I did bring slides, and we'll see if they work or not. It's always a challenge on the new ABC. Maybe this will work. How do I advance? Oh, that works. I'm not going to read you these slides. I just kind of put these up here for y'all's entertainment benefit. Basically, chicken product labeling and all food product labeling, especially meat, poultry, and eggs, is done by USDA. And USDA FSIS, or the Food Safety Inspection Service, those are the inspectors of the plants and the people in Washington, approve all labels. And there's approximately 200 labels are submitted per day to their offices, and probably five were reviewed. Now, I'm a former USDA employee, so I can make fun of USDA. Labels must contain some types of certain information, and then there are also a lot of voluntary claims I'm going to go through here in a minute if they work. What is mandatory? The product name or description, of course. Some handling. Is it fresh? Is it frozen? Are you supposed to keep it refrigerated? Net weight. The company name and information, as far as information, as far as address information. Inspection mark and P number. P number is the exclusive plant number that every poultry processing plant is assigned. So you can look at the P number, and if you know where to look for it, you can find out what the plant of origin was for that product. Country of origin, that's kind of an interesting one. That's kind of gone through the gyrations of government over the years, but basically what it came down to is another branch of USDA, AMS, has required that retailers give their customers the country of origin of that product. So it's not actually an FSIS directive, it's more an AMS directive. And so just passing that backwards, the producer or the retailers have passed that back to the plants and said, please put this on the label. So it is a mandatory thing. Of course, safe handling instructions, how to handle the product, how to cook it, ingredient statements, and nutritional facts. The nutritional labeling came about, I guess John said, when his hair was white. Nutrition labeling came about when I used to have hair. So. Some of the voluntary information, I'll go through just a couple of these. The USDA grade mark from AMS is just the badge, grade A. You don't usually see grade B chickens, you just see the grade A chickens, which is good. And just a few of these claims that you will see on different packages, which I'll show you in here in just a minute. Process verified, free range, and all these others. Let's see if I can get this to work. What is USDA process verified? It just means that there are certain plants in the U.S. that have been certified by providing information to the USDA regarding the age of the bird, the source of the bird, the feeding program of the bird, that has been certified by the USDA as being a process verification. I think right now, the last time I checked for my class, there was one Tyson plant and a number of Purdue plants that are approved for this program in the U.S. Free range, hear a lot about that. What does that mean? It just means the birds have had access to the outdoors. So if y'all tour the chicken houses, somewhere in a free range chicken house, there would be a small door about this big, and it'd be opened up, and the birds can go out there if they want to. Most of them don't. because, you know, they don't like to go outside because of the predators. They're a little, and of course, all the food, the water's inside. Naturally raised, you hear that sold in packages. What does that mean? No growth promotants, no antibiotics, but coccidia stats are allowed. No animal byproducts in the feed. That's what that means. And literally processed. What does that mean? It just means that USDA's definition is the product has not been changed dramatically from its initial product form. Was that clear enough?
Does that mean it's not been injected?
At this point, that's coming up next year. At this point, minimally processed can be injected.
Okay.
Those are going to be changing in 2014. And then organic, you've seen that before, and I'll explain that at the end of the presentation. So, I want to show you, probably most people have seen this in the grocery store if you go shopping for chicken. I do want to give a disclaimer here. When I did this, put these slides together for my class last year, some of these slides, I didn't choose these two products I'm going to show you. These were what was in my freezer at the time. Unfortunately, they are still in my freezer a year and a half later. I found that out last night when I looked. So, two products, one's a Tyson product, one's a Purdue product, that's what you're going to see. So this is probably what you're used to seeing in the grocery store. Looks similar, right?
Yeah.
But all that stuff on the label just didn't get there by chance. It's all been regulated, the labels have been approved, everything on that label has been overseen by the USDA, and this is a very complex subject, and most of these, there's actually a lot of consultants and label experts in the country. I'm not either, but they will help you get your label approved if you need it. Looking at some specific things here, hopefully. You see on there, you see the net weight on there, that is required, that's mandatory. You'll see the P number, P-622, that's required. There's a use by sell by date. USDA does not require a use by sell by date to be on that package. However, your customers will. So it is almost always going to be on there. The product description, standard of identity, boneless, skinless chicken breast with rear meat. In this case, this was also containing up to 15% of a natural, you see the asterisks by natural, chicken broth. And so you have to explain what natural is. First of all, you explain what the chicken broth is and the ingredients on the ingredient panel. And then you say that it's merely processed, that means it's not been changed from its natural form. Product of USA, required by the retail customers. Fresh, keep refrigerated, that's your handling statement. I'm not sure how good those slides are showing up. Can you see them in the back? Okay. And of course, the nutritional label panel, that's been on there for the last 24 years, roughly. And safe handling instructions, telling you how to cook, how to handle the raw chicken, and how to cook it. In this case, the cooking procedures are just below this panel on this package. Okay, to change gears a little bit, this is the other package in my freezer. This is some Purdue Italian chicken breasts that have had more processing done. They've had more ingredients added to them. They're still a raw product. Again, you'll see some claims on there, some voluntary claims, USDA process verified, all vegetarian diet. The words did not have animal byproducts on the diets. Raised cage-free, so these broilers were not in cages. And you see at the bottom, no hormones or steroids added. I'll explain that in a minute. More information, the USDA process verified badge, the USDA grade A badge, both from AMS and USDA, and then the FSIS inspection sticker, or what we call bug in the industry, with a P number on the bottom of it. Product of USA, and you see at the bottom there, no hormones or steroids are added. And I do want to say that it's not that they weren't tried, but in the United States, steroids or hormones have never been added to poultry. And the reason is very, very early work, more than 50 years ago, showed that the mammalian hormones that were available were given to chickens in a research setting, did not work. Chickens didn't respond whatsoever. And so the advent of nutrition, genetics, and housing advances negated the reason for even adding or thinking about adding steroids or hormones. So chickens and turkeys, et cetera, have never had hormones in the United States and probably never will. If you want hormones, you can eat beef or drink milk. That's what it's at. More stuff on here, the solution ingredients. You see there are much more ingredients, more spices added to this. And you see at the bottom there that the company information, Purdue, Salisbury. And you also have to, a lot of labels get rejected because they don't put the zip code on there. The zip code has to be on there. And safety instructions. I did leave a little bit of the cooking instructions that were just above it. It's showing cooked to 170 degrees Fahrenheit. The USDA requires 165, but most people build in about 5 degrees if you use a meat thermometer to cook the product to make sure that you have achieved safety. And again, the nutritional label, nothing special there. You see a lot more of this on the market these days, these more niche market specialty brands. You see the term free-range chicken, organic chicken, all natural chicken, and all those have certain things that they mean. Natural means just meat, there's no artificial ingredients were added to that product. It was minimally processed. You know, so we'll go back and argue about what minimally processed really means. Free range, again, as I said before, just means that there's a hole in the door that birds could go out. You may have seen pasture raised out there in the world. USDA does not recognize pasture raised as a label claim. They have not done the work and they have not done the review on that to allow that to be a claim on any product that's poultry. On the smart chicken does also show air chill. That is another way of processing birds in the plant. So what does organic mean? And this is just a little bit of stuff here. 100% organic can be on a label if all the ingredients in that product and all the processing of that product were organic or met the organic standards by the National Organic Program up in Washington. And if you do have an 100% organic product, you can use the USDA organic symbol, such as shown here. If you have only 95% organic ingredients and organic processes, you can label organic as a word, and you can use the USDA symbol. If your ingredients are 70 to 94% organic, who's counting? You cannot use the USDA organic symbol, but you can put this on your label in a prominent position, made with organic ingredients. And then lastly, if you have less than 70% organic ingredients, you cannot use that on the label, but in your ingredient panel, on the back of the package usually, you can say organic and specify those ingredients that are organic. So there's just an incredibly brief summary. If you're interested, you can go on the USDA website and get these handouts. Some of these are 200 pages long, so enjoy those. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith. John, you're ready.
You asked the question earlier that you said was always asked, and I think when I've done presentations on animal welfare, which is fairly new as a subject, I don't think, one of the questions I get asked almost every time is, why are we talking about it? So I thought that might be a good way to start. And the only way to start there is kind of with the poultry industry itself, give you a little bit of background on how we ended up where we are. But the industry's been evolving since its inception, sometime around the World War II, the end of World War II. And along with the evolution, efficiency's improved. And this was a direct result of knowledge and education. We learned about mechanization. We learned about genetics. We learned, more importantly, about vitamins and what their function was during the early periods. All these improvements and medicine, Dr. Gleason, all these improvements allowed the farmers to become more efficient, and therefore it took less labor to produce more food, or even less resources. And in fact, I've seen a statistic that 1950, one farmer could feed 30 people, and in 2010, that same farmer could feed 155 people. So that's quite a change. And as a result of this, there are fewer and fewer people actually associated with agriculture. And that has dramatically changed the way people view animals in many ways. Most people get their experience from animals, their contact from animals at zoos or with their pets. And in fact, they've started looking at many farm animals as pets. And once you assume pethood, name the animal. And how many of you have dogs or cats that somebody celebrates its birthday? Tell the truth, you know. That influences the way you look at all animals. And it has opened the doors for criticism of animal agriculture. Some of it has been just in the past. Fortunately, I think that most of the bad actors out there have been exposed one way or the other, and the numbers are diminishing. But as with just about anything, there are always going to be a few people that are kind of the bad seeds, if you would. But there's something you need to keep in mind, point out yesterday. A lot of times, procedures that look good are not good. And sometimes procedures that look bad are in reality good. One we saw yesterday, if the little three-week-old bird, you can see some of them in masses kind of huddled together. When you see a picture of a chicken house where they're talking about the birds all crowded together, look carefully. Very often you'll see that there are open spaces in that barn. The chickens huddle together because they're flock animals. So taken out of context, that picture can make it look very bad that there are a lot of birds in a facility. On the other hand, if you've seen it, I have seen one pasture-raised flock that was just spectacular until you got inside and started to really look at the situation. Those birds were in no way protected from predators or from pathogens. And it's kind of amusing in a gruesome way. I gave a lecture to some backyard farmers, hobby farmers in Arkansas, a few weeks ago, and we talked about predation in particular. And about a week afterwards, one of the people in attendance happens to be in our department. He's a hobby farmer. He had some backyard chickens. He came to me and said, couldn't believe it, but his favorite chicken got killed by a skunk. And said now he was enclosing his former backyard chickens. He was making them a coop so that he could keep them in. They were fenced in and even putting a roof over the fenced area. So it's a serious issue. So you have to make trade-offs. In addition to that, over the last two decades, there have been groups of scientists studying animal behavior in many different ways. It's an important science, an important bit of information, but it only tells part of the story. We have to look at the whole animal in order to determine its well-being. For example, as Dr. Wilson was talking about earlier, their health, a sick animal of any type, doesn't have a very good welfare situation. You know that from when you don't feel well. Nothing is right when you're sick. An injured animal is the same way. So bird health is critical. In addition to just whether they have their normal behaviors or have what others perceive as enough room. So, what we are doing now is combining all of this. We're looking at the physiology of the animal, its behavior, and its environment. Somebody talked about the lifestyle of cow earlier, Isabel. That's what the way the whole system works together, which has changed our view of a lot of things. Animal science organizations are all over this country, got together, I think virtually all of them, and formed a independent organization called PACO. Professional Animal Auditor Certification Organization. And what they did was put together this group that actually does training for people that are going out and doing welfare audits of farms, and then certify them to make sure that the people going out and doing these audits understood what they were seeing and therefore were able to give good evaluation. So I'd say today that virtually every chicken that enters the retail market, you could say virtually all poultry that enters the retail market, has been audited by one or more of these certified independent auditors. At the same time, we're still continually doing research and looking at ways to improve the welfare of the chicken that we have in our care. And I hope after yesterday, you have a pretty good idea that it's not necessarily the picture that you may have had. And maybe dispel some of your negative impressions. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Okay.
Kendra, if you'd like to go ahead and give us your opening statement.
And again, if you have questions, go ahead and write them down and pass them to the Senate.
Well, first up is a little bit of a history slide. I apologize. It is quite technical, but these are going to be some of the terms that you've either already heard on the tour yesterday, or certainly you're going to hear in the news in the coming months, and definitely for those of us in the industry, we've been talking about this for quite some time. Last year, the first of last year, USDA published in the Federal Register what they refer to as the Poultry Modernization Act. You know, a lot of today and yesterday's presentations were history lessons about the poultry industry, and some of today's my talk will be about the history of how we've slaughtered chickens in the U.S. But this is truly modernizing, or the proposal that's out there is truly modernizing how we might potentially process broilers in the United States. But of course, the goal of the USDA was to have this implemented the first part of this year. That has, of course, not occurred. We could probably have some discussion afterwards as to what we think will happen and when we think it'll happen. But I'll walk you through today a little bit of what's in the proposal, at least. But to do that, I do have to get a little technical with you regarding some of the terminology. But I think after your tours yesterday, a lot of this will make a little bit more sense. If you actually look in the Federal Register, or excuse me, the Code of Federal Regulations about poultry slaughter in the United States, there's technically only two regulations in there that you'll see, and you'll see that referred to in the industry as CIS and as NELS. CIS being what we saw yesterday at the Sanderson plant, the streamlined inspection service or system, excuse me, and then the NELS, the new line speed. And for those of you that have been in the industry a while, it's kind of comical to refer to it as the new line speed because it's been around for quite some time. And then anything that you would see other than those two systems would require a waiver from the regulation, often referred to with my staff as a hall pass. Basically, you know, it takes a long time to change the regulations that are in the CFR. And so if USDA wants to move a little faster than that, you usually are granted a waiver from the regulation. And again, that's documented. The facility would have that on site, you know, as far as a waiver is concerned. And then, of course, not to confuse how we slaughter our birds with SIP, or the Salmonella Initiative Program, and I can answer questions about that as well. But those are some of the acronyms that I'll be using today or that you may have already heard. But this is really what drives it all home. Is what does this mean? You know, make it make sense to me. So what you saw yesterday was the CIS system, and that actually is running at 70 birds per minute at the maximum. But there's two USDA inspectors on the line, and depending on what tour group you were in, I think we kind of pointed those out. Try not to be rude to the USDA inspectors, but they're there wearing the bump caps with the USDA shield on it. They're inspecting each bird. But one thing that you probably noticed, or maybe you didn't, there was two inspector stands, and beside each one of those inspectors was a Sanderson employee helping that inspector, referred to as an inspector helper. But what those inspectors were doing was inspecting every other bird on the line. So each inspector was inspecting 35 birds a minute. That's a very important number when we start talking about the modernization of poultry inspection. The USDA's labor union still only requires, or restricts, it's another way to look at it, poultry inspection to 35 birds per minute per inspector. So when we talk about the different kinds of inspection, that's still going to be the same number. So NELS, you didn't get to see that yesterday. That's 91 birds a minute. That's three USDA inspectors on the line. So again, never exceeding 35 birds a minute per their contract. And then if you have a facility in the United States that doesn't run those two systems, back to what I said before, you would have a waiver from the regulation. It's called a new technology waiver, even though it's been around the high-speed lines for over 20 years. But you will have a waiver to run that new technology, those new evisceration systems. And those new evisceration systems can run up to 140 birds a minute. But if you run 140 birds a minute, you'll have four USDA inspectors on the line. So again, each only inspecting 35 birds per minute. But again, back to what I said about waivers. We do have 20 processing plants in the United States that have a waiver that's referred to as a hemp waiver. And this was actually a pilot program. It was started over 14 years ago. But I've got the acronym up there for those of you that want to know. Again, we're full of acronyms in this industry. But HEMP stands for Hazard-Based Inspection Model Project. Again, we call it HEMP. But of those 20 plants, Pilgrims, the company I represent, we do have five of them, so we have 14 years of experience running at this particular line speed. But that line speed is on the same processing equipment that other facilities run the high-speed wavers. So this is technology that's been in Europe, been overseas for quite some time. But again, this was a pilot, and we'll refer to some of that data later on. So what USDA is proposing is not any one of these four. Oftentimes, hemp is confused with the new poultry inspection. It is a slightly different proposal, and I'll go into that here in just a second, about what it would look like. Depending on what tour group you were on yesterday, there were a lot of questions asked on the bus and during the plant regarding, okay, help me figure out what exactly would the new poultry inspection look like. This might help you. I've got some of just kind of the brief bullets. It's obviously a long document. There's quite a few things that would change if this were to go to final rule. But the first thing is it would be plant employees that are actually doing the inspection up on the stand that you saw yesterday. So when we say plant employees, so that would be the actual processor's employees there. But there still would be a USDA inspector on each processing line. It would be at the very end of the line before going into the chiller. So this is similar to hemp as far as a floor plan layout would go. And again, the line speed waiver does allow the processing plant to go up to 175 birds per minute, or at least, again, this is what's in the proposal. Then as far as other things that would change, I think you've seen in the news the comments about this would put the onus or the responsibility of quality parameters back on the processor, and it would put more food safety requirements on USDA, and that's exactly what it's doing with some of these bullets that I have up here. The first one being what we call in the industry the finished product standards. Those would change in this proposal. A lot of those finished product standards have to do with quality parameters like feathers. USDA, most USDA at least, would concur with me that a feather is not a food safety issue. It's very much a quality issue, and we have specifications for that. We have customer expectations. We even have grading services to discuss feathers. But those would be essentially removed from the regulations, and it would be on the processor's responsibility or their specifications to control some of those processing defects. Another thing that has been removed from this proposal is the chilling requirements. And you say, well, that's pretty important to food safety and quality is to chill the poultry. Absolutely. We don't disagree in the poultry industry. But what USDA is saying there is, you know, everybody's process is different. What you do with that bird when it exits the chilling system, or even how you chill the bird, is different depending on what you're going to do with it. If you're going to process that product like we saw yesterday and put it in a tray, you may want a different temperature when that bird exits the chiller than a plant that might go immediately into deboning and further processing with it. So they put that burden of the responsibility of the chilling and the chilling temperatures and the data behind that to validate it back on the processor. So then I added a little bit of information here based on some of the questions that were at least in my tour group yesterday, but I think this is important here as well, that, you know, what would happen to the USDA inspectors if this were to go through? You know, if you took on, say, for instance, a high-speed line where there's four USDA inspectors currently and you only put one at the end of line, what would happen to those other three USDA inspectors? Well, what happened in the hemp program when we rolled that out was those three inspectors were given additional training and were then deployed onto what we would call the floor, but they were roving around the facility, truly focused on food safety tasks, checking paperwork, checking other requirements per the regulations. That's what is proposed in this new poultry regulation as well, is that those folks would be deployed in to do other tasks throughout the facility, so they wouldn't immediately be eliminated as far as that goes. And then I know one of the journalists from Food Safety Net was asking, you know, some questions about what about, you know, when you look at the different kinds of processing equipment, it's very important to USDA to observe the viscera. So how does that change in either hemp or in the new poultry inspection? Because they're at the very end of the line before the birds go in the chiller, and so they're not able to see the viscera with the carcass. So how would that work? So here's the explanation that's in the proposal right now, is we would have to notify USDA every time we switch flocks or farms and give them the opportunity to go and observe 300 of those carcasses and their matched viscera to make sure that flock health is what they expect it to be and allow those birds to be processed at our facility. So some of the just common misconceptions or questions that I certainly field quite a bit, I'll go through some of those, again, kind of preempting you with your questions, some of these that I just assume there might be. But you know, some things that we've seen in the news or in the media was comments that our line speeds would increase by fivefold. But going back to just simple math and the explanations that I gave you on the first slide, the USDA inspectors, yes, they do inspect only 35 birds a minute. But that's where the fivefold increase came from, was poor math by possibly a reporter once upon a time to figure out if you're currently inspecting 35 birds a minute and you're allowed to go to 175, they're like, that's five times faster. No, no. It depends on the processing line that you're running. The line speed would, of course, increase, but the way the inspection would go would, of course, not. Another is, again, you know, I call it cowboy math, but some folks immediately said, oh, my gosh, if every plant in the United States can run 175 birds a minute, and they start up the very next day, you know, they start doing all this kind of, you know, kind of math about what the industry could do. But now that you've all gone through a poultry processing plant, it's going to make a lot more sense when I explain that this isn't possible. You know, if you took, you know, the state-of-the-art facility that we went through yesterday that's set up on a CIS line, so it's set up to run 70 birds a minute, if we handed, you know, this legislation out tomorrow, that facility could not run 175 birds a minute. They don't have those additional two inspector stands or three inspector stands to be able to, you know, increase the line speed to that. You also saw the layout there. It's a very large facility. It's very spacious. But if you go in other poultry plants in the United States, we're very cramped as far as floor plan. So there's not the additional room to add those inspector stations or the trench drains that would go underneath it to remove some of the materials. I've heard some estimates that it would cost about $3 million to retool some of the older facilities to be able to run the new poultry inspection the way it's currently written at 175 birds a minute. So this would not be something that's done overnight. You couldn't just flip on the switch if it was published today on the newswire or anything like that. The other thing I want to emphasize is that the change is not mandatory. The way the current proposal is worded, USDA gives you that option. It's a voluntary program, so if you don't want to invest that kind of capital and change the processing facility to run 175, and you prefer to do it the conventional method, like the CIS method, then that is currently the way it's worded in the proposal, how you would be given the option. Another thing that I've seen is the increase in line speed is unsafe. It's unsafe for the USDA inspectors, and it's unsafe for our employees. Of course, we have 20 plants in the United States that have run this for over 14 years, so the industry has wonderful statistics to be able to prove that that is certainly not the case as far as our employees' safety and welfare. And then the last one I had on there was the defect rates would increase. There's a lot of people that assume that if you run at that line speed, it's unsafe, there's going to be more defects, there's going to be processing issues, that it's just impossible to process chicken at 175 birds a minute. Again, this is where I want to commend USDA for starting the hemp pilot, you know, 14 years ago to collect wonderful data so that we can refute claims such as this. You know, one statistic we like to brag about in the poultry industry is there's not been a hemp location, so a pilot plant that's run at that line speed, ever get enforcement action with USDA. So USDA's never had to step in and take control of a facility that's been in the hemp pilot program. But that's kind of a little brief summary of the new poultry inspection.
Great explanation. Thank you, Kim. Such a good explanation. I'm going to give you an easy question.
Okay. How's that?
And we're going to skip straight to the audience questions because we are running out of time. So first one up here, Kendra. Are there any broilers raised in cages on large chicken farms here in the United States?
Not to my knowledge, no, sir.
That's
for
only,
the mob, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's only the layer business. And like the way we do things in the chicken business, there are a lot of reasons, and there are advantages and disadvantages to any housing system. And certainly, cage layers provide a very efficient way of producing a lot of eggs per pound of feed. Now, you know, there's it's one of those things that doesn't look very pretty, right, Yvonne? But it does provide a low cost protein product. So, thank you, Kim. Doug, if I can point this one at you, don't label claims like cage-free, no hormones and steroids, just confuse consumers since they're not used anyway?
Yes.
That was an easy one, too.
Well said, sir.
It's kind of pointing fingers that don't need to be pointed because we don't use cages, we don't use steroids, never have, so it's...
A lot of people don't know that.
Could I just add to that?
Correct.
We do a lot of consumer research, and unfortunately, 50% of consumers do think that we use hormones and steroids.
That's right.
And they have for years and years. And two-thirds of our consumers think we raise our chickens in cages.
That's right.
So we feel the obligation to let consumers know that we don't. Even if it's a law, that there's a misconception out there.
Maybe USDA should allow those label claims to be larger on the package. That's because instead of in the fine print under an asterisk somewhere.
But I think that's the explanation why some folks choose to do it, is that people don't understand it. So they want, some people will choose to emphasize it on the label. Mon, can you explain how you use antibiotics for, or how we use antibiotics for prevention versus growth promotion?
Asking me instead of Dr. Glisten.
Okay, I'll let Dr. Glisten. I'd like the next one for Dr. Glisten.
Do you want me to take it, or you want to take
it?
Okay. Those terms they overlap. Reality is most of the antibiotics that are labeled for growth promotion have been on the market 50 years. And when FDA allowed those claims for growth promotion, it was easy to show that the birds grew better when they were on these antibiotics. We really didn't know how they worked. Now we know how they work. We know that they're actually preventing disease. So the growth promotion label is still there for the time being. Some companies still use growth promoting antibiotics. But FDA has set a chart to stop that, remove those claims from the label. We don't have an exact date for that, but it's probably going to be toward the end of 2016 that there'll be no more growth-promoting antibiotics used in the United States.
Okay. Can you explain what ionophores are?
Yeah, ionophores. How long do you want me to take? Short. I'm going to make it short. Let me just say, you know, I look at antibiotics probably a little different than most of you. You know, antibiotics have been here for millions of years, and they're produced by microbes in the soil. They're nothing new to anybody except us. And when Alexander Fleming, in the early 1900s, discovered penicillin, he named it after the mold that produced it, penicillium. And what that set off a whole area of research in the early 1900s, that there were microbes in the soil that were producing something that would kill bacteria. Fast forward, you know, 60, 70 years, there's been hundreds and hundreds of these antibiotics produced or found in nature, and some of them have become products that are used. The interesting thing is a lot of these natural compounds, like penicillin, affect things other than bacteria. I'm getting to what ionophores are. Ionophores are antibiotics that affect protozoa. What's a protozoa? Parasites. The most important intestinal parasite in chickens is coccidia. That's our number one disease. So this is an antibiotic that's not used anywhere in medicine because it affects protozoa. It's by definition an antibiotic. And you see all these huge numbers of how much antibiotic is used in food animals in the United States. Probably 40% of that is ionophores. They're used to prevent a protozoal parasite in the intestine. There's no counterpart for it in human medicine. And to FDA's credit, they're not talking about ever taking that away from us. Some of these antibiotics actually affect insects. You've probably treated your dogs for fleas with an antibiotic called ivermectin. Most people don't know that's an antibiotic. So these antibiotic is a big word. Some of them affect bacteria, some of them don't, and only a very few are used in human medicine. Most of them are too toxic to use in human medicine. That's a long answer, John, but sorry.
Okay, thank you. Just for having a long answer, I'm going to give you another question. What role will genetic modification play in meeting the global demand for chicken in 2050?
There are probably some other people in here that could answer it better than me, but I suspect that it's not going to play a big role. The genetics companies that we have now use traditional methods, and it's been highly, highly successful. And they're continuing to make improvements every year for growth rate, feed conversion, yield and all the things that we need, disease resistance. And so at this point, there's not a great need to make a genetically modified chicken. The traditional methods that have been used for years for selection are working very, very well. So I don't expect to see it anytime soon.
Okay. Yvonne, why do the birds in the chicken house seem to get so little light? This is probably from our visit yesterday.
I'm sorry, seem to get so little...
light?
Light?
Light.
Light. Oh, light. Oh, okay. Well, it has been determined they actually get plenty of light. It's dim for you. But it keeps them calmer to be in a somewhat low light situation. And that is better for their behavior and their welfare in general. But they are, the big issue with the birds is not the level of light, but the contrast. They have dark and they have light. Their light seems low to you, but if you, well, I don't know that I can because I'm past that age, but if you could, you could read in that light. But unless you're my age, you have to put it on the floor and stand on a chair to do it. But it is much better for the chicken's overall welfare for them to stay calm and to have the lower light.
Good answer.
Okay. All right. Kendra, how does FDA fit into what and how the poultry industry conducts its business?
Oh, very good question. You know, of course, FDA ultimately controls, you know, all food, but labeling legislation, you know, if we look at any of the labels, FDA is certainly where you start first as far as labeling. They're involved in any drug claims or any of the items that we feed our poultry, our rendered products. So, you know, that is quite a large percentage of our business or the byproducts of our industry that end up going into the pet food. That's, of course, regulated by FDA. A lot of the ingredients that we bring into our processing location, so breading, marination ingredients, et cetera, are regulated by FDA. But probably the biggest distinction for us is their presence in our organization. Of course, our products are ultimately have the shield of USDA on them, not FDA. Our USDA inspectors, as we mentioned before, and that was the topic of my conversation, are present at all times, anytime that we're slaughtering birds. An FDA inspected facility, and Pilgrims has some FDA inspected facilities, usually only come the FDA officials, and sometimes they're subcontracted, often only come into our facility one time a year. So there's quite a bit of presence difference as far as the two.
Okay.
Hopefully that answered.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep going after
okay,
you.
Okay, good.
and we understood from your talk that going to a hemp or going to this modified line speed would be optional, or is it mandatory?
Currently, the way it is written is optional. Of course, during the comment period, because it's not going to the final rule, National Chicken Council did submit a lot of comments regarding how we would like to see this proposal go into final rule. If USDA certainly listens and responds to National Chicken Council's comments regarding our suggestions on how to implement this, it would be entirely voluntary.
Okay. And our European competitors and our Brazilian competitors, are they operating on these kind of line speeds or not?
Absolutely. Some of the high-speed lines that we run in the United States at 175 and the hemp plants run well over 200 in Europe safely. And, of course, they share those data with us. As far as Brazil, I apologize. I should know the answer to that, but I do not know the processing equipment that they use on.
I do know the answer, and they do. It's 200 there as well. Yeah. Won't the cost, but coming back to whether it's mandatory or not mandatory, at the end of the day, won't the cost of staying in the existing program or the slower speed program become prohibitively expensive? Because keeping USDA inspectors is more dollars than the hemp program. Can you comment on that? Or aren't the companies paying for the inspectors, or how does that work?
Well, you know, I think that the first math exercise that you need to do when you look at it is the scale of the facility. You know, again, I apologize, I keep using the plant yesterday as the example, but since we've all been through it, it's a good one. You know, just because you could retool the line and run it at 175 birds a minute doesn't mean the back end, as we call it, of the facility could handle that same volume. It doesn't mean that the chiller, and you know, we had Mr. Morris from Morris Chilling, you know, talk about that system. Doesn't mean that that chiller could handle it. Doesn't mean their deboning area, where you saw the team members that were, you know, disassembling that chicken, could handle that many more birds. and possibly that customer mix is not supported, you know. So that's one decision that we make or will make in Pilgrims, as well as the rest in the industry, is would you make a change to the facility? Do you have the customers? Could you, you know, do you have the additional capacity out in the field now that you've seen it all the way from the farm, all the way through the processing plant? We discussed, again, this, I believe, at lunch yesterday with some of the folks at my table. If you take a facility, again, like the one yesterday, that's running a 6.5-pound live weight, if they wanted to make the business decision to change the product mix for that facility to go to the 4-pound fast food bird, like we, you know, gave that statistic earlier, or a 9 or 10-pound live weight bird, that substantially changes what occurs out in live production. So for instance, if we needed to raise those birds up to 8 pounds, just like Yvonne was discussing, the density of that house would have to change. We would get the same number of pounds out of that house, but not the same number of birds out of that house. So there wouldn't be enough housing capacity, you know, in the area. You might not have enough hatchery capacity either. We toured the hatchery. We know exactly, you know, how many eggs would go through that hatchery. They shared those numbers with us yesterday. You couldn't increase that by 20% or anything else overnight. You know, the number that we share often is it would take us 2 years to substantially change a complex as far as their product mix and their bird size and all the infrastructure to support it. So as far as cost, I think the USDA inspection difference is minor compared to what we would have to do as far as our product mix, our plants, our feed mills, and retooling the whole operation if we wanted to make a change like that.
Okay, thank you very much. Tom has given me the hook signal saying that we're done. But before I hand the microphone back over to him to give any housekeeping announcements, let's give the panel another round of applause.